Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and as promised, Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press, the most important, are you ready, Mark? The most important Catholic press this side of Andromeda Galaxy. I expanded it. He is here with us to answer your questions, and any question is welcome about the Catholic faith. 888-318-7884. You should also be aware, Mark enjoys talking with a variety of different types of people: Catholics, non-Catholics, ex-Catholics, future Catholics. Anybody in any of those categories, welcome to call 888-318-7884. I especially want to make the invitation to non-Catholics. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, something you don't understand, or if it's something you don't like, that's fine too. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Hello, Mark Brumley. Thanks for being with us.
No, thanks for having me. It's great to be with you during this Advent season.
It is. And thank you for saying Advent season. I keep meaning to say it every day and wish people a blessed Advent, because I just feel like there's a lot of people that usually go to daily Mass who aren't able to right now. Just don't experience it in the same way with, even Sunday Mass. A lot of people aren't able to go to Sunday Mass. So thank you for that, reminding us about Advent.
I'm happy to do so.
Do you get a chocolate every day when you open your Advent calendar?
No, I do not.
You don't?
There is an Advent treat coming from Ignatius Press.
Oh, nice segue. What's coming from Ignatius Press?
Well, the first volume of Cardinal Pell's Prison Journal is out now. It's in the warehouse and shipping out to people. And this is the journal he kept when he was unjustly imprisoned for 13 months or 14 months, whatever it was, on false charges against him. He kept a journal, and it's a fascinating spiritual read. It's ultimately going to be three volumes. The first volume just released just a couple days ago.
Oh, I cannot wait. I am going to get that. And you guys are publishing it here in the U.S. or –
We are. We're publishing it worldwide, but it's going to be available in throughout the world, but especially in the English speaking world, written in English. It's just really it's kind of interesting because he suffered unjustly, and he was in prison. He was in solitary confinement for a time, and all this, and I don't want to make light of what you would expect in a spiritual journal, because it does deal with the spiritual nature of the injustice to be wrongly accused and internationally shamed and locked up and all this kind of stuff. But it's also interesting that just very human elements, comments about, watching televangelists and things of that sort.
Oh,
and
wow.
What goes on in prison, and it's just very human. He is a very spiritual man. Don't get me wrong, but it's not kind of artificially pietistic. So it's very fascinating.
That's great. Yeah. So a human portrait, in other words.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, cool.
And of course, when he wrote it, he didn't know he was going to be released. For all he knew, he was going to be in jail for the rest of his life.
Yeah, right. And so, what's the name of the first volume? Does it have a? It's not just called the first
Prison Journal, Volume 1.
Prison Journal, Volume 1. All right.
Yeah.
I hope that is not the title of my first book. that's great. Congratulations on publishing it. And I'm going to really look forward to reading it, because I have always been a fan of Cardinal Pell. And this was a baffling and sometimes horrifying kind of event where you realized, man, it seems to me quite obvious that there was a pretty sturdy dose of anti-Catholic bigotry underneath all of this. And the Cardinal took the full brunt of it.
Yes, and we still don't know all of the possible reasons why this happened to him.
I bet you do.
But
I bet you do.
I know some people. So if you're interested in having him on the show, I'll talk to some. I'll talk to my people and see
people who know what really happened.
Well, no. If you're interested in having Cardinal Pell on your show, I will talk to some people for you.
Can we just get a screeching halt noise to play? Of course we want Cardinal Pell. Yes. The answer is yes, we want Cardinal Pell. As a matter of fact, if we get you off right now and get Cardinal Pell on, we would do that.
I think he's in the other room. I'm going to ask him to come in. And
why do we have Brumley on? Okay. Yeah, so if that was a sincere offer, the answer is yes.
So I can't speak for his schedule, but we will do our best to try to get him on, because I think it would be really good for Catholic Answers people, listeners, to hear about Cardinal Pell and all that he's gone through. So anyway.
All right. I want to have that. This is a totally different, probably completely unrelated, but I also would like to have that new African cardinal. And now I can't pronounce his name. I'm going to say it wrong. From Rwanda. Have you heard about this guy? His family killed in the genocide while he's studying at seminary. You need to get a book from him, too. I want to read. Get on that. I'm very helpful to you, Mark Brumley.
You are.
I have no contacts with the guy. Never met anybody who knows him.
You're helpful to the whole Catholic world. Let's be honest.
I just want you to get all these cardinals, get a book, and then get them on Catholic Answers Live. If you could do that.
I'd really be excited about getting some St. Louis cardinals.
I know you would. I know that you are one of the remaining St. Louis Cardinal fans, and congratulations. Did I say that wrong? I apologize. As a guy who lives in San Diego, God bless the Padres, love the Padres, but it's a different level of thing than the St. Louis Cardinals.
We're from St. Louis. We moved to San Diego. We had the Padres. We prayed for them.
Yeah.
We've moved to the Bay Area. We have the Giants. but we're still Cardinals fans. Anyway, I know we got lots of listeners. I see the numbers are adding up, so we should stop talking baseball.
I am in charge of this show. All right, let's go to.
I'll take over,
Brumley.
It's my dominant personality.
You're just used to being the boss. All right, let's go to Toronto, Canada. Watching on YouTube Live is Richard in Toronto, Canada. It is open forum. Mark Brumley is our guest, and Richard, Nick, will you put him on for me? I got a problem here. Richard, you are first. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Can you guys hear me?
We can hear you fine. Yeah.
Can't hear you.
Perfect. I got a question for you guys about where to draw the line in terms of morality, sin, and then implementation is into making it illegal. So like we know, for example, with abortion, you've got politicians that'll say, I'm against abortion personally, but I'm not going to make it illegal. And then I think rightfully so, those politicians are castigated. But then what I think about is, like, what about other sins like adultery or sodomy, where, like, is it okay to vote, let's say, for a politician that is okay with keeping sodomy legal, even though it's a sin that cries out to heaven?
Right.
And if it's okay, then why is it not okay to then vote for a politician that supports abortion? And I understand maybe if both politicians support sodomy being legal, then it doesn't matter at that point. But let's say there was one politician that said it should be illegal. Do we always have to vote for him in the same way that we would for abortion? If not, what's the reason why?
Mark?
Very good. Well, I didn't want to jump in there, Si, because I know you're running the show.
Knock it off, Brumley.
So anyway, thank you, Richard. Appreciate the question. And it is a challenging question. I can state some general principles and with the recognition that sometimes applying these principles to concrete particulars can be a challenge. So the general principles, the law is, as St. Thomas Aquinas described it or defined it, is a rule of reason, promoted or promulgated, issued by an authority who has responsibility for the common good. So it's a norm or a standard of reason that the mind perceives, and it's directed toward conduct of people, and it's to foster, promote, provide for the common good. That being the case, we're going to see that there are many things. Well, let me back up and make another point. You asked a question about sin. When should sins be illegal? There's a distinction between sin and wrong. Okay, sin is a way of understanding what is wrong, what is wrong for human beings to do, what is wrong in terms of action in relation to God. We don't speak of sins in relation to civil law. It's not as if evil. Take something like murder. We know that the commandment, thou shalt not kill or thou shalt not murder, says that murder is a sin. But we don't typically refer to crimes of murder as sins. We say they're crimes. Okay, a crime is a violation of a law that exists to promote some kind of social good. So we know in from our Christian perspective, God is the source of all good. So those things which are sins are contrary to the good. But we can think about good and bad, right and wrong, the purpose of human life, and so on, without directly or always referring to God. And when we do that, you know, when we think about society trying to promote the common good, the good of all the people in a community, there are certain actions that are contrary to the common good and certain actions that promote it. And those actions which are contrary to the common good, for the most part, are what we call crimes. So we pass laws and say you can't act this way because it violates the common good. You must act this way to do things to safeguard the common good. So when it comes down to the question of something that's sinful or wrong in relation to God, what God has revealed about his law, we have to ask the question, well, does outlawing it protect and promote the common good, or does it create more problems than it solves? So again, going back to St. Thomas, St. Thomas recognized that not everything that is immoral should be illegal, because in the effort to stamp out everything that is immoral, a society would create even greater problems. Imagine, is blasphemy, is uttering a blasphemous statement, is that immoral? Yes. Is it sinful? Yes. Should we outlaw making blasphemous statements in the privacy of someone's living room? Well, you could say we could pass a law against it, but how would you enforce that law? Would you have the state monitor people's living rooms so that, you know, should they happen to utter a blasphemous statement, the state is there to come in and, you know, punish them and so on? You can see that doing certain things would bring about greater harms than allowing the sinful thing or the wrong thing to happen. Okay. Now, how does a society come to determine which things should be laws and which things should not be illegal, even if they are wrong? One of the principles related to the common good is the idea that human beings have certain human rights. And so generally, laws support or foster the recognition of human rights and prevent or outlaw things that are violations of those rights. Sometimes we have to tolerate something because we can't deal with it effectively, but we can never legalize or treat as a right something that is contrary to human rights. So you gave the example of abortion, and sometimes people talk about abortion and they'll talk about it as if it's simply a question of sinfulness or immorality. And so they'll say, well, you can't impose your religion on me by making abortion illegal just because you think abortion's a sin, or you can't impose your morality on me to make abortion illegal simply because you think it's immoral. Well, it's not simply that it's immoral, it's that it violates a human right, the right to life for unborn children. This is why people who say things like, well, you know, I am opposed to abortion, I think abortion is killing somebody and it shouldn't be done, but I am opposed to making it illegal. This is why people who take that position are misunderstanding. The reason why abortion should be illegal is because the right to life for unborn children must be recognized by the state. The state exists, and the laws that the state promulgates exist to protect and promote the common good, including fundamental rights such as the right to life. That's why abortion must be illegal. It's not enough to just simply say, I'm opposed to it, I'd never do it, I'd never encourage somebody to do it, I'd discourage people to do it, I'd work to provide alternatives to abortion. Those are all commendable, important things. But this is why the church teaches it's an obligation on the part of Catholics to support laws that recognize the right to life of unborn children, because those laws fall within the responsibility of the state. The state is obliged to protect and promote all without exception, human rights, including the right to life. Anyway, I've said a lot about this subject, but does that give you some basic orientation in terms of trying to understand distinction between sin and crime and between morality, private morality, and what we might call social morality and the obligations of justice in terms of what's legal and illegal.
Yeah, I've read Aquinas on this, but when we look at adultery, for example, it's clear that it's right in the common good to make adultery illegal. That's unambiguously bad. And when we look at sodomy laws, we do have a history of them being implemented, and no law is implemented without abuse, but I do think there's a history of at least it being implemented semi-successfully. So again, right, I go back and I say, if you've got a politician, two politicians, one supports abortion, the other doesn't. Unless the one that doesn't support abortion is going to launch nukes at someone, unambiguously Catholics got to vote for that guy. Same with, let's say, sodomy. If you've got two politicians, or adultery, two politicians, one is pro-sodomy, the other's not, everything else is more or less equal, then would a Catholic have to vote for the one that's going to make sodomy illegal? And if not, why is it being treated differently? And I understand the right to life is more important necessarily than maybe what two guys or two girls do together. But, like, if it's an intrinsic evil, a sin that cries out to heaven for vengeance, isn't that a strong enough case to be made that, A, we would want our politicians to want make sodomy or adultery legal? And I'm just harping on those because those are two easiest ones to come up with, but I'm sure there's a list of other ones.
Right. Well,
Mark, I have to do the break. So, sure. And I apologize for that. Richard, you got to wait for your response from Mark Brumley, 60 seconds or so while we do this break.
Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Cy Kellett. Don't forget to check out the latest episode of our podcast, Catholic Answers Focus. You can listen each week to the world's premier podcast on Catholic apologetics at CatholicAnswersFocus.com or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Catholic Answers Focus, now available at CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
Why do we need to pray? We don't pray because God needs our prayers. We pray because we need God's grace. And every day, when I face the day, I realize I have no idea what I'm doing, and I need God to walk me through my day, step by step, giving me the grace, the counsel, the love, the encouragement that enables me to glorify Him in everything that I do and become the person He wants me to be. Prayer is my lifeline.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Actually, in the midst of a fascinating conversation, I'm very interested in this question, a very sophisticated question, and Mark Brumley, just the right level of sophistication to answer this kind of question. Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press. But I just want to boil it down for anybody who might be joining us right now. Essentially, the question comes down to, do you have to... in all instances, prefer a politician who would make sodomy illegal. And several times Richard has pointed out that sodomy is referred to as a sin that cries out to heaven. It doesn't seem to be in the same category as, as many other simple basic moral failings that it would make no sense to make laws against. So you want to wrap that up, Mark?
Well, I'd say I think there's a good case that there should be laws against sodomy. But the question comes, what if you violate that law, what's the consequence? So you can say, well, it is possible for people to engage in acts of sodomy in the private sphere. And yeah, while there's harm that's done to them and there's harm that's done to a society that says – it's okay, it's a good thing, or if not saying it's a good thing, it's a question that we leave entirely to the private determination of persons whether they think it's good. I think that does harm to society too. It's just I'm not sure what the – in order to avoid all kinds of related harms, yeah, unintended harms that can come – and that sometimes existed places where there are sodomy laws. I think you'd have to frame this very carefully, and so I'm not sure how to do that. But yeah, I certainly would acknowledge the principle that that homosexual acts, done privately, are not good simply because they're private.
Yeah,
and they shouldn't be encouraged or treated as good or neutral simply because they're private, and that there is an instructive function of law
Sure.
That, you know, certain things are illegal in order to tell us what human beings are and what human relationships are. So I can well understand the idea behind sodomy laws and things of that sort. I also understand, though, there can be all kinds of social problems that that arise if you try to enforce those kinds of laws.
Yeah.
And so on. So
that's where Richard, I would say, is more sanguine than I am, and it sounds like than you are, that such laws could be enforced consistently and justly. I don't think the record is very good on that. I don't think it's as good as Richard posits. It seems to me many, many people have been violated with great injustice because of anti-sodomy laws. And I don't feel quite as sanguine as you do, Richard. You want to just give us a closing comment, Richard, because we do have to move on. We got a whole bunch of people on the line. But this is a wonderful topic, very interesting. Richard, you want to say anything before we got to let you go?
Yeah, this was hypothetical. I just was thinking about the underlying principle. I don't have any gripe with sodomy in particular or adultery. One just a quick point, guys, sorry to interrupt. Is,
sure.
One thing I've been searching up on a lot is sedevacantism, and it would be great if like Trent could have someone on to explain, because it seems like an absurd concept, but I want to see it well defended. And Trent had on a fellow that was pro-gay marriage, a pastor, and it would be interesting to see something like that on your show.
All right. Everybody's got suggestions today.
Who's running the show?
Telling me how to do
side.
My job today. All right, Richard. I think that's quite right. By the way, I mentioned that brand new cardinal from Rwanda, the first cardinal ever from Rwanda, but I couldn't remember his last name. Antoine Kambanda is his name. Kambanda. And he just seems like such an impressive person. But go ahead. You wanted to say something.
Well, I'm going to tell you a little story about African priests. I was once in an environment where there was an African priest. Actually, our associate pastor in my parish is an African priest, but I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about another priest, African priest. And there were a group of young people there, and there was one particularly boisterous young lady who asked an awkward question, which was she asked the priest's name, and he gave her his name, and it was a, you know, an African name, but it was not easily pronounced in English. And she said, "Why do you have such strange names?"
And he
was such a great man that he said, "Well, we have strange names because we want you to try hard to remember them, because then you will think well of us."
Oh, what a sweet person.
So then he said, "Why do you have such strange names?"
Yes.
She said, "Have strange names," and he said, "But to Africans, to many Africans, your names are strange."
Yeah.
So anyway,
it's
interesting.
I'm sure she thought about it later and realized what. There's no one in Africa that has a strange name. It's an African name. It's not strange. Right. It's just not the names you have.
Of course, 10 years from now, she's looking back, she's gonna say, "I can't believe I said that."
I hope she's listening right now, and I hope she feels terrible. Abby in Montevideo, Minnesota, listening on Real Presence Radio. You are next. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Hi.
Hi, Abby.
So the first part of my question is, do you know what alkaline hydrolysis is, or should I explain it real quick?
I'm familiar with it. Yes, it's a kind of a chemical, biochemical form of kind of like cremation.
Yeah. So they put the body into a chamber with a solution that's water and alkaline, and they sort of shake the chamber, and throughout a period of time, it sort of dissolves the body, so that all that's left is like the bones and then like a sludge.
I am not sure that I'm happy you described that, Abby. I'm not sure. I have very mixed feelings about this whole question. But okay, so now that we have a sludge and bones, what is your question about? Wait, let me see if I can say it. Alkaline hydrolysis.
Yes, alkaline hydrolysis. So my question is, it's much friendlier for the environment and much more cost-effective for families than cremation and embalming, like an embalmed burial. And so my question, the church has said that it's wrong because the solution, or that sludge that's left goes down the drain. The bones are given to the family or ground up the way cremated remains are and can be buried properly. But that sort of, I don't know, well, for lack of a better term, sludge that the body turns into through that alkaline.
We'll say liquid residue.
That's for my benefit.
The liquid
Thank
residue
you.
Of the body gets dumped down the drain. And obviously that's disrespectful to the body that is a temple. And so
Abby,
my question is.
Go ahead. Your question
sorry.
Is.
My question is. One, what's the why is that condemned? The draining of fluid from the body during the process of embalming and then it being dumped down the drain, that isn't okay.
All right, we'll get to that right after this.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
Bishop Joseph Strickland of Tyler, Texas, is one of the most courageous leaders in the church, known for his outspoken support of unborn life, Orthodox faith and morals, and reforming Catholic institutions. In his groundbreaking new book, Light and Leaven, he offers a forthright perspective on the state of the church today and calls on the lay faithful to meet its challenges boldly. Touching on topics including parish renewal, the centrality of the Eucharist, the need for prayer and silence in a noisy and distracted age, and the battle between good and evil in the church and world, Bishop Strickland's wise insights and evident love for souls will inspire and edify you. To order your copy of Light and Leaven, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, the art of caring.
Feeling burnt out? Need a break? We'll help you find peace.
That's tomorrow on More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We have a very pleasant and friendly guest, Abby from Montevideo, Minnesota, online, who I hope you know that I was just teasing you, Abby, that I was unhappy with your question. I'm just a squeamish person. And when the word sludge came up, I felt a little squeamish. That's all. But we're talking about you described a process called alkaline hydrolysis, which is a way of I suppose one might say preparing a body for a human body, or maybe I guess anybody's body, animal too, for disposal. And you said, why does the church ban this? And it doesn't ban embalming, or it doesn't ban
cremation.
Cremation. Thank you for helping me. I'm going to turn that over to Mark. Have I got the question right, Abby?
What I was going to ask is, why specifically? Because what's left after alkaline hydrolysis is the liquid remains in the bones, and the bones, similar to cremation, can be buried and disposed of properly. My question is sort of twofold. So one, why does the church condemn dumping those liquid remains down a drain, but it does not condemn dumping the fluids from the body that come out during the process of embalming down the drain?
Okay.
And also, if that liquid remain that's left after the process of alkaline hydrolysis, if it were to be dumped on a special drain, like what's in a sacristy, or if it were to be, buried in a cemetery as well, would that be
more
an acceptable burial in line with church.
All right, fair enough. We got it, Abby. Mark, lay it on us.
Couple points.
Okay.
Couple points or several points. One, I'm not an expert on this. Two, it is my understanding that the Holy See, the Vatican, hasn't issued a norm on this for the Universal Church. So I don't know if I would, if it would be accurate to say that the church has condemned this. Point one, point two. Point three, I know particular bishops' conferences, episcopal conferences have, and I think it's because they regard the process of reducing the physical elements of the body, apart from bones, which can't be reduced by the alkaline hydrolysis process to liquid, that they regard the reduction of the flesh to liquid and then, you know, the dumping of that, they think that's a disrespectful treatment of the body, that it's a destruction of the body. Let me make a little distinction. I think there's a distinction between draining fluids from the body and disposing of those fluids and taking the whole of the body and reducing it to fluids and disposing of it. So it's more of a reduction of the body in the latter case than there is in the former. Fourth point, I do think that what you describe, if you were to take the liquid and dispose of it in the manner that you described, that that would be more respectful. Whether that would meet the objections of those bishops and those moralists who think that the very process itself of reducing the body to what some would say it would be a non-natural fluid residue, when it would meet their objections, I don't know. My view of this is, and this is just Mark Brumley's view, is that this is an area the church has not come to a final conclusion on, that because there's no overarching pressing moral need to use alkaline hydrolysis, but there are questions that reasonable people raise about what's happening to the body when it's employed. A number of bishops have issued statements and guidelines and norms on this, and they have the authority to do that. And so I think that we're going to see more discussion of this as those points that you raised get more generally raised in society, and people in leadership, especially in the Holy See, address them. That's my take on it. I hope that's helpful.
Abby, thank you. Thanks very much. Appreciate your patience as we went to the break as well. Let's go to Mike now in Bellevue, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Mike, go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Yeah, real quick. I remember several years ago I was listening to the show, and it came up the question of kneeling after receiving communion. And I seem to recall that they said that it was not really something that was necessary, that it was just kind of a norm that had developed, or almost like a cultural thing or something. And, you know, my knees are a little sore at my age, which really is secondary, because, you know, I'm thinking if a person already has Christ in sight of them, then that idea of kneeling, you know, I assume the kneeling is because, you know, he's there on the altar as well. I was just wondering, did I hear that right there a few years ago, or was I mistaken?
Do you have to kneel after receiving communion, Mark?
The answer is no, you do not. Yeah, it's a good devotional practice that has emerged, and you know, we kneel, a number of reasons for kneeling at Mass, okay? And those include acts of adoration, especially at the consecration, acts of devotion, you know, times even when the Blessed Sacrament, say, is not in church, it's still not inappropriate to kneel when you pray. And I sometimes kneel in my home when I'm praying. Blessed Sacrament isn't there. But you're not required in order to fully and actively participate in the sacred liturgy to kneel after receiving communion. It's good and it's appropriate. But it's not required. You do not sin, nor do you violate any required liturgical norm, you know, if you take to your seat. And certainly not the case if you have bad knees. So,
thanks, Mike. Appreciate that question. We go now to Andrew in Georgia. Andrew, your question for Mark Brumley.
Hello, sir.
Hi, Andrew.
Please allow me to frame this. I'm not the best speaker, and I'm going to try not to use a ton of your time. I grew up in a very devout Protestant Southern household and a very devout Southern community. Became an atheist, then an agnostic in my late teens, in college. My last 2 years of college, I met a friend who was really into the Summa and liked to study that sort of stuff. And after many years of patience and debate, I became convinced that there is a God, a deity, a one, whatever you might want to call it. And I'm attracted to Catholicism in some aspects, but the problem is I feel very culturally alienated.
Mm-hmm.
Where I live, there are only two churches that are feasible for me to attend with my transportation. One only has one mass in English, and my schedule just doesn't work for that one. And the other one, I'm like the only non transplant. And regardless of what you may think about Southern Protestantism as an identity or its flaws and history and all that, it is what I am deep down. And mm-hmm. I don't know why. I always feel out of place in Mass. I went through RCIA twice, actually, was not accepted either time. I decided not to be because I feel like a foreign object.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, that's it.
So would you just like Mark to help you with that? Did you want to ask a more specific question? Because your story is very compelling, and I want to make sure we're doing what you want, Andrew.
I admit I did not have a very precise question. I just wanted general advice
okay.
on that problem.
Great. All right. Mark Brumley.
Andrew, I come from an evangelical background. As I was exploring Catholicism, it felt awkward, strange, and bizarre to me. After I became a Catholic for a time, certain aspects of Catholicism, which I had come to affirm as true and good, nevertheless felt a little awkward to me. And so I can relate to what you're describing. I'll say this. I remember when I was evangelical, we used to give out little campus crusade booklets and where, you know, the four spiritual laws and all that kind of thing. And there was one of these booklets dealt with the issue of people making a commitment of faith to Christ and not feeling different. And the phrase that was used was feelings follow faith. They don't lead it, they follow it. Feelings may or may not be involved, but you know, faith is a commitment. It involves a commitment, act of the will to believe God and trust Him, and so on. And I used that maxim that I had heard and actually said many times to other people who said, you know, I don't feel like I'm any different even though I've made a commitment to Christ and so on. I used that maxim to understand my own spiritual experience. And, you know, I remember when early on as a Catholic feeling very awkward and, you know, asking for Mary's prayers or praying the rosary or something like that. And then after about 10 years when I was teaching Catholic school, I showed my students a video of Our Lady of Fatima, the movie Our Lady of Fatima, with Ricardo Montalban as the narrator. And I'm standing in the back. My students are watching this movie. And I found myself, you know, as the story of Our Lady is being described, I started crying, you know. So something that I had originally experienced or thought of as blasphemous, wicked, evil, and depraved, you know, from Satan and so on, you know, within a period of time, acting on my faith, I found that my feelings had been transformed and I'd come to see it differently. So I know a number of other people who come from strong Protestant backgrounds have said the same thing, that, you know, you ask God to help you with these things, but when you come to a conviction of faith, even though you're going to find some things feel awkward, strange, and you may feel out of place, if you are persistent in your commitment of faith and you ask God to help you over time, you'll see a transformation of your heart that corresponds with a transformation of your mind that's come about through the light of faith. So that's what I encourage you to do. I encourage you to talk to other Catholics and maybe some Catholics who are converts, and I'm sure Catholic Answers can help you connect with some of those people or at least read their stories. I would really encourage you to do that.
We always recommend the Coming Home Network. They're very, very helpful in connecting with. I mean, they have great. This is what they have experience with. I'd be happy to also send you a couple books. I mean, that we can definitely do that, Andrew. But what Mark said, does it resonate with you?
It does. I think it's a little different than what I said, but it's probably my fault rather than his. I understand. It's not that I don't feel different. It's just that I don't know. I just feel. I feel like everyone else is part of something, and I'm not. Like, I'm different, you know, because in the one church, I just don't speak the language. I don't speak a word of Spanish, and this is like a very.
Well, right, like, and that's a challenge. Right. Yes. And So obviously you're an English speaker. You come from an Anglo background. You're going to feel more comfortable going to an Anglo Catholic church and speaking English. Yeah.
I live in Southern California, and there's a lot of people who feel that way. I mean, you know, a lot of Spanish speakers. That, you know, I mean, that's just the case. That one's kind of an obvious one. But that feeling out of place. That's a tough one, and I can't help but feel that might even have involved some temptation, in a sense, to try to keep you out of the church, tempting you to feel that people are not like you there. And I imagine if you hung around, you would find there are people quite like you there.
Thank you.
Hey, why don't you just continue to call? We'd love to continue this conversation.
Yeah.
And call back. You know, Mark's on. We try to have him on as little as possible, but at least once a month we have Mark on.
He's always bothering you.
So. But you can call any time, especially during open forum. But if you'll hang on, maybe we could just send you a couple books. I mean, you just continue your reading. Obviously, you've studied, but we do usually send out Why Be Catholic, and then The Bible is a Catholic Book, a couple of kind of introductory level books, and just to have them around. If you want them, you don't have to take them.
Someone like Steve Ray might be good because he comes from a Baptist background.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he can talk to you about that. And also, you know, go to the parish priest, tell him your story, and see if he has people he knows who might, you know, have a similar background and might help you feel more part of what's going on.
Yeah, Steve Ray is one you might want to look up. I'm forgetting his website, but you can just look up Steve Ray and it'll bring it to you. We got to take a break though, Andrew, and I apologize for that, but thank you for the call. We'd love to be here for you in the future as more things come up, or as you just want to continue the conversation. I'm supposed to brag about the podcast right now before we go to the break, so I'm going to brag about our podcast a little bit. We on Catholic Answers Focus, we got two two very, very, they're kind of different, but very interesting episodes. A lot of people worry about the sin against the Holy Spirit, and they worry that they might have committed it, and for good reason. I mean, if Jesus says there's a sin that's unforgivable, you probably ought to know what it is. So we asked Father Hugh Barber, and he explained it, and I'm pretty sure your mind and heart will be set a bit at ease, although you will be alert to where the possibilities of committing this sin, but you'll feel much safer, I should say. So you can get that. That's our Monday episode. In our Wednesday episode this week, we thought, who could we get to that could help us work through the Satanic Temple, which is becoming so popular? And they have these seven tenets, and we said, who can give us a philosophical kind of analysis of the Satanic Temple's tenets? It was Carlo Broussard, of course. So you can find, if you're interested in that, or maybe you are yourself a Satanist and you're listening today and you'd like to hear a Catholic kind of response to Satanism, that's at CatholicAnswersFocus.com. Also, Trent Horn did a podcast this week. We'll be right back after this.
Your questions, Catholic Answers, live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Hey,
everyone. This is Carlo Broussard from Catholic Answers. When you were a kid, wasn't it exciting as you waited for Christmas? I know it was for me. The church recognizes that this sense of excitement in anticipation for something great belongs to us as human beings. This is why she gives us the season of Advent, a time to rouse within us a sense of childlike excitement in preparation for the greatest gift of all, Jesus Christ. So, be a child of the kingdom as you anticipate the child who is our King.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Mark Brumley is our guest. It's open forum. Anyone can call with any question at all about the Catholic faith. And waiting on the line is Brooke in Indiana, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Hang on, Brooke. Just hang on a quick second. I'm going to get to you here, Brooke. Brooke, are you there with us?
Yes.
Oh, hello, Brooke. How old are you? You're 9 years old. You're far away from the phone, Brooke. We're having trouble hearing you. Can you come closer?
9 years old.
Oh, you're 9 years old. Okay, well, it's very nice to have you on. Brooke, what is your question for Mr. Brumley?
So my question was about the three wise men.
Okay.
So it's about the gifts that one wise man gave him: Jesus, gold for kingship, and number two was frankincense for a priest, and myrrh was from an anointing of the balm, and from someone who died for us. And I just wanted to know, did the three wise men know that Jesus was going to die for us?
Man, that's a good question, Brooke. That is a really good question. And I think he's right about the three gifts and what they represent, Mark. So did they know?
Well, those three gifts would certainly be gifts that would be valuable even to somebody who wasn't going to, you know, suffer and die on the cross. So they would have value as gifts that you would give to a royal figure, a kingly figure, a very important person in God's plan of salvation. Did they know that there would be a way of thinking about those gifts that related to Jesus' passion and death on the cross for the sins of the world? We don't have any indication that they understood things to that degree, but we can't rule it out. Who knows? It's possible. They certainly seem to understand passages from the Old Testament, what the Jews at the time would have regarded as the whole of Scripture, better than some of the Jewish leaders and scribes. So perhaps they also had an understanding of, say, Isaiah 53 that prophesies the suffering servant better than some of the people in Jesus' day. So we don't know for sure. It's not necessary that they had that knowledge, but it's possible, and there would be nothing crazy about the idea that in fact they had some understanding of that or intimation that might happen to Jesus.
Is that okay, Brooke? What do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah? All right.
Very good.
Brooke, I hope that you have a very Merry Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Amen.
I said it that way because some people, I don't know, get very uptight if you say just plain old Merry Christmas when it's not Christmas yet. You got to know.
Well, you're making clear that you know it's not Christmas.
Right. So, yeah. Brooke, that was all right.
Good job.
We're giving away a book. All right, hang on the phone, Brooke. We're going to give you a book. A book for Brooke. Dakota in Kentucky is next. Hang on a second, Dakota. I'm having trouble with the phones today. Hello, Dakota. You got a question for Mark?
Oh, yeah, man. How y'all doing?
Very well, man.
So did the Catholic Church, did they change the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday? Because I've read a lot about this, and I just wanted it was very interesting to me. So,
fair enough. Did the Catholic Church move Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday, Mark?
I'm going to say no, and I'm going to say no because we don't understand Sunday to be the Sabbath. The Sabbath is the seventh day. And it, in the Old Testament, was part of the covenant and part of God's commandment to observe the seventh day as a way of acknowledging the goodness of God's original creation and God's saving act in bringing Israel out of bondage in Egypt and establishing Israel as his new covenant people, as the beginning of a process of bringing about a new creation. So that's what the Sabbath meant. In the New Testament, when Jesus dies and rises again on the third day, you know, comes back to life, he's resurrected, transformed by God the Father on Sunday, then what was the way of acknowledging God by honoring a certain day related to God's actions, what had been the Sabbath, gets transformed into the first day. You know, it's the first day of the week, the first day of the new creation. So Christians don't worship together on the seventh day, which is the day of completion for the old creation. Rather, because of Jesus' resurrection, what God has done in raising Jesus from the dead on the first day of the week, Christians celebrate the new creation, the beginning of the new creation, which is what Jesus' resurrection is all about. And we look forward to the completion of that new creation at the end of history, when we will have the super Sabbath, the Sabbath of the final Sabbath, entering the fullness of the rest that God intends for his creation. So Christians, because of what Jesus has done through the resurrection, God has done, look at the Lord's Day no longer as the Sabbath of the Old Testament, the seventh day of the week, Saturday, but rather they look at the Lord's Day as the beginning of the new creation, the first day of the week, which is Sunday.
Now, how is that for you, Dakota? Does that make sense to you?
It kind of confuses me because, like you said, Jesus was risen on the first day of the week, which is Sunday, and the seventh day of the week is Saturday. And so one of God's commandments, fourth commandment, remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. So why are we worshiping on Sunday if the Sabbath is Saturday?
Well, that commandment, we have to interpret, as we do everything in the Old Testament, as we do everything in the Bible, we understand that commandment and we understand the rest of the Bible in light of Christ. Christ is the interpretive norm, the standard that Christians have for understanding the Old Testament. So just as the other commandments or the other things in the Old Testament are understood as pointing to Christ, and some of those things like circumcision, some of the dietary requirements of the Old Testament, the Mosaic Covenant, were things that had to do with that covenant and the God's purpose in calling Israel as a people to prepare for the coming of Jesus, just as we now interpret those things in light of Christ, and some of those things aren't practiced or aren't practiced the way they were in the Old Testament. So circumcision is no longer a sign of the covenant. That's been transformed into baptism. So the commandments in the Old Testament had to do with circumcision, even though they were given by God, even though they were part of his covenant, even though they were his commandments. That when we understand them in light of Christ, that they were pointing to Christ and the new covenant, when the new covenant comes, those commandments don't apply in the same way as they did. Similarly, with respect to the Sabbath, that pointed to the old creation and God's establishment of the people of Israel. Well, when the new creation begins and the new people, the church, is formed, we interpret that commandment in light of God's bigger purpose.
Thanks, Dakota. I appreciate that. I hope that was helpful to you. You could probably hear the music, which means we have come to the end of this hour with our good friend Mark Brumley. Mark is president of Ignatius Press. Ignatius Press puts out many, many wonderful books, but we can recommend to you without reserve, even without having seen it yet, because just by reputation, the new Prison Journal, Volume 1 from Cardinal Pell. And you can get that now, or is it about to come out?
It's out now. It's shipping today, so
oh, very good.
Order it. Then go to Ignatius.com to order it, or the local Catholic bookstore.
Mark Brumley, thank you. I have a lot of fun with you. Thank you for doing the show with us.
Thank you. God bless you, man.
All right. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.